Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
Well, I say law firms are from Mars and clients are from Venus. Law firms simply want to systematize and solve problems and say we know the answer, whereas often the client actually often just want the partner to listen. Would you just listen to our position?
In the previous episode of IDN with Richard Susskind, author most recently of The End of Lawyers? We discussed his predictions for how the future will bring greater efficiencies to the delivery of legal services. In this second half of the interview, Richard extends his vision of the future to what he believes will be even more radical and innovative change.
My role in life, I suppose, what interests me is to look at emerging technologies and say, what if they could be applied in law?
Despite lawyers and clients sometimes appearing to be from different planets, he predicts new technologies will enable them to work together in ways never seen before. We first focused our attention, however, on a frequently debated subject: how lawyers traditionally charge for their services, and whether the billable hour is destined to survive.
My take on the billable hour, I can only answer that by reference to my model of how legal services are evolving, and very quickly, and if you can imagine a flow from left to right of five arrows, I think that legal services are evolving through five phases, what I call it: bespoke, standardized, systematized, packaged, and commoditized. Now, it's not key to understand each of these elements, but the bespoke service, which is the highly tailored, highly customized service where the lawyer essentially crafts a solution from a blank sheet of paper, if genuinely legal work falls under that heading, it tends to be open-ended, it tends to be requiring quite a lot of creativity, and I think it's well-suited to early billing. But hand and heart, most work is standardized or systematized and beyond, and the further you get away from bespoke, the further you should get away from early billing. I often quote a story about my daughter, who, she was 12 at the time, and she asked for a summer job, and I asked her to put some of my business cards in a database, and she said she'd do that, and she said, how much will you pay me? And I said to her, well, I thought I might pay you by the hour. And she paused for about 2 seconds and thought about that and said, well, I'll take my time then. It seems to me if a 12-year-old can see the problem with early billing. So there you go.
But I'll tell you, I'm less skeptical about I'm more skeptical about the end of the billable hour than Brazil. I've actually lived through experiences of regimes where we didn't have the billable hour. In fact, in Italy, the practice generally is to use a fixed fee basis, or rather an Italian tariff schedule.
Yeah.
And you wind up with something that's like a fixed fee for many disputes. And we actually shifted from that because we found it very difficult to assess the amount of work that was being done and the quality of work when it was all on this sort of quasi-fixed fee basis. There are valid reasons and I think it'll survive.
I agree with that entirely. And I do think it'll survive, but I think it'll be a diminished in role. I think, just to be clear, I think it's simplistic when people say it'll fade away. It won't. What I'm saying is that, following my idea of decomposing work, if you break work into different tasks, I think you'll find some of the tasks that make sense to charge on an hourly billing basis and others that doesn't.
Well, you know,
slicing and pricing, some people
call. You're right. In fact, now that I think about it, I think that there have been times where, for document reviews, we've got the systems where, you know, you got 100,000 documents, you get a fixed price. It's easier when you've got closer to a commodity to come up with a fixed price.
This is the point.
That
my whole thesis, it's hard to capture it in a few minutes, is precisely that. Is that the further you get away from the traditional, as I say, bespoke service, the more inclined you'll be to say, actually, can you do this on a fixed cost basis? So I think it's entirely possible with a piece of litigation, you might say, well, there's 10 tasks involved here. 3 of them need to be done on an hourly billing basis because, frankly, they're open-ended and it just makes sense. But 7 of these, the document review, the litigation support, the legal research, frankly, we'd like that done at fixed cost. So I think we need a more nuanced, a more subtle, a more sophisticated approach to charging. And so I get very nervous, I think, when I read a proposal from a law firm to an in-house lawyer and say, the alternative, we've moved from hourly billing to fixed fee or to cap fee or volume discount.
Yeah.
I think that's missing the point, that most GCs just want to pay a fair amount. And a fair
that's
amount
right.
seems to me will depend on the tasks involved. Some tasks suitable for our
I'll tell you, I've got a lot of fixed fee proposals.
Yeah.
and they make me nervous.
Yeah.
They make me nervous because you want, and maybe it's the tendency of the in-house counsel to also want to be able to micromanage when you want to be able to micromanage,
right.
But you want to have the transparency to see what the work is that's actually getting done.
I think that's right. And different parts you'll feel differently, though. Some you'll say, okay, that's okay for that to be a fixed fee. Often otherwise, you'll think, actually, I do want to give them a bit of room for maneuver here. I don't want them to feel they have to do it, they're under the cosh and so forth. So I think we need to think in a more, I think, subtle way. Right. I just go back to this idea that the minute you bring the production manufacturing mentality, you divide up the tasks, you actually need to think through each task as a little individual piece of work and say, for that task, how should it be resourced and how should we charge for it?
By the way, there's one little tweak you can give to the billing system that does help, what we've found, and that is that getting monthly bills.
Mm.
A lot of lawyers don't like to bill on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
And when you actually can get the data in real time and you can see what you're paying, then if you do have issues with the cost, you can raise them.
Absolutely.
It's one of the problems with billable hours. You often don't get the bill for a year or two later. And then it's kind of hard.
And it's a huge surprise, absolutely. Yeah. I'm a big believer in online financial reporting. You should, it seems to me, be able, as a client, to go online and see how much of your money's been spent, who's been doing what, how many hours and so forth. That basic information should just, it's actually in your external firm's information system. So all you're saying is, can I have a view of these systems? I certainly would advocate that for any in-house counsel. In-house counsel. I think also that if you are managing as many of GCs are, a whole bundle of external law firms, to have one standard way of reporting in makes it simple.
So you can compare apples and
apples.
Absolutely,
yeah, that's right. To have that that body of information about who's advising you at what rates and so forth, fantastically useful to be able to compare.
I can tell you, where we've been able to come up with standard products that we want to purchase from a law firm, and we go out to law firms to get the different quotes, you get variables, I mean, a 500% to 600% variation from among firms.
Yeah, sure.
All among firms that are qualified to do a particular type of work, but you can get an enormous range of variation. Can we quickly talk about technology?
Well, I was going to say, I mean, really the technology comes in relation, it comes in many ways, but it comes in relation to the collaboration strategy, which is the second strand. So you remember I was saying that the challenge is how to deliver more for less, and the efficiency strategy for me is about breaking work down into tasks and sourcing it in efficient ways. The second, and we touched on a little earlier, but the second, I think, more ambitious and more radical technique is the collaboration strategy, where you say, how can you come together and share the costs and share insights? And that might be anything from, say, sharing standard form documents or sharing knowledge resources, right through to saying, if we're having this analysis done of, say, some set of regulations across 90 different jurisdictions, why do we each pay towards it rather than each individual client actually incurring the cost? But for me, we've seen historically examples of collaboration amongst clients, but not particularly, I think, compelling business cases. But for me, what the most interesting thing is the emergence of social networking tools, Facebook-like tools, new ways of maintaining a network of contacts, of collaborating, of communicating. And I know a lot of senior lawyers think that Facebook and the like is just the playthings of our children, but actually these are very, very powerful tools that allow us to work differently. And I've already seen numerous examples, even over the last year, of clients coming together and collaborating. So local authorities in London, for example, 7 different local authorities, different legal teams, they're actually collaborating together, sharing experience and ideas. I know in various sectors, say in the banking sector, even as early as 2003, there's a group called the Banking Legal Technology Group, when originally 9 banks asked 5 law firms to collaborate in producing a single knowledge portal, one place online for them to go where the knowledge would be stored. I've spoken to senior GCs in a whole bundle of different sectors who said, actually, we might come together and see, are there opportunities for us actually to bear the load collectively? Very early days, but the intuition here is that very seldom, as an in-house lawyer, will you face a problem that no one has ever faced before.
Right.
So maybe a first port of call is other in-house
lawyers.
Particularly
in common law jurisdictions, you're working off a precedent, and you're actually looking for the case that somebody else has faced before.
Exactly. But I mean, one very simple observation is that within major organizations, it's true to say there's often a lot of duplication of effort and reinvention of the wheel, and one part of the legal department might have faced precisely a problem that another part has faced before, but the communication channels aren't in place. Now, we call this knowledge management. How do we capture, share, nurture, and reuse our collective knowledge and experience internally? That's a very obvious collaboration strategy. The more radical one is external organizations coming together and sharing knowledge and insight. And I'm optimistic that the more we think about it, the more we'll see opportunities popping out. I know it's not something that's going to happen over the next 18 months in a big way, but I think over the next 5 to 10 years, this actually might change the landscape altogether. But collaboration doesn't just stop there. I'm very keen where General Counsel have panels of maybe half a dozen or a dozen major law firms, that these law firms start behaving in a more collaborative way with one another. So they become almost as though they are one virtual law firm, an extension of the legal department that they're advising. Now, often...
Hard to see that with big law firms.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. And there's a number of organizations, I think actually your own might be one of them, that has been pioneering this idea of trying to encourage lawyers to behave more collaboratively. It actually does impose a burden on the General Counsel, because GCs, for better or for worse, often play law firms off one against the other, which I think is slightly unhelpful. But I heard a marvellously interesting talk some months ago from the head of legal services at one of the big supermarkets chains in England. He was talking about how he'd got six law firms, and he'd actually just made it very clear to them, if they all behave well, they'll all get a good amount of the work. But really, he wanted them to behave as a team, and sometimes he'll want to draw lawyers from different firms to work together in a team, his dream team, and he had them actually setting up one set of training modules, one knowledge resource and so forth, and they really were behaving like a virtual team. And I think this is now possible, again, through the kind of collaborative technologies that we're seeing emerging. But there's all sorts of other technologies that have nothing to do with collaboration, like automatic document assembly. I think huge potential there. It for me, when the history of the legal technology is written in, say, 30 years' time, I think that technology will be to the legal profession as spreadsheets were to the accounting and tax professionals. And if you speak, interestingly, to a senior executive about the production of documents, they cannot imagine that a huge amount of this isn't already automated. They would immediately take, again, the production mentality. Workflow technology, particularly if you get high volumes of quite often low margin but very similar types of work that, frankly, we're handcrafting today, we can introduce the kinds of technologies that have been so successful in the insurance industry and apply them in the legal world. What about, fascinated too by what I call the electronic legal marketplace, if you can auction goods as we can, look at eBay, tens of billions of dollars worth of goods traded every year on an auction basis, just park that thought for a second, or think of reputation systems. You want to know what hotel to go to, you can go to TripAdvisor and see what other people thought of that hotel. Or what about price comparison systems, where you can find out about the cost of cars or insurance policies and find the lowest cost? Why can't we have all of these auctions, reputations, price comparison systems, and law? And the answer is, in fact, there are good illustrations and case studies in each of these already in play. I don't think they're so useful for the high-end work, the bespoke work, but where you've got fairly humdrum, fairly routine and repetitive work, why not just be able to go out there and find out who's available, what their reputation is?
Well, and I disagree with you that maybe it wouldn't be valuable at the high end.
You think it would be there as soon?
Well, let's put it this way. Not necessarily for the lawyers, but for the people who are private adjudicators, the arbitrators and the mediators.
Yeah, I can see that.
The market in those areas right now suffers from what I would call asymmetries of information.
Yeah, well, I was going to use the same phrase. That's exactly the point. Yeah, that's exactly how economists would define it. And we have a graver and greater asymmetries in law than almost any other market.
Resistance to overcoming that. Everybody wants to hoard the information that they have, and it prevents the growth of the market. It prevents the adoption of mediation, prevents the adoption of arbitration.
It's very interesting there, actually, because you could see that working. Well, reputation systems would be very important there. Mm. It's interesting you use the language of economics, because another way of summarizing all that I've got to say is that market economics haven't really swept through the legal world yet.
Right, yeah.
But when you think of the efficiency that I'm talking about, you think of the collaborations, you think of the use of emerging technologies, all I'm seeing is the kinds of techniques, technologies, systems, processes that have worked so well in so many other sectors.
Why wouldn't they work in the legal
indeed,
profession?
Yeah. And that's the broad premise. I'm not saying they all will, but I think most of them will, and I don't think we should think somehow that the law should be immune from these kinds of changes. And there are so many fascinating emerging technologies. There's no finishing line in technology. Even something like video conferencing, absolutely fantastic. Yeah. The latest generation telepresence.
Yeah,
it's just amazing. Oh, yeah. Absolutely amazing. And the potential there, it's costly just now, I accept that. But as with all these technologies, the cost will come down. And the interesting thing about that technology is not going to get any worse. It's just going to get better and better. And that leads also to the idea of why do we congregate physically together to resolve disputes? And will the next generation, the internet generation, the generation who can't remember the pre-internet world, will they want to come together in a room to resolve disputes? Why?
I would have been highly skeptical about that before telepresence was introduced, because I've tried to do hearings conference.
Yeah.
You know, and it's fuzzy, it's jerky.
Agreed.
You're in telepresence. Somebody joked one time, you only go get you a cup of coffee.
Absolutely.
You know, you're in the same room.
No, unbelievable. And I think once you've seen it once, you think, wow.
Yeah.
So that again, I think will change the face of litigation. So the. But my role in life, I suppose, what interests me is to look at emerging technologies and say, what if they could be applied in law? And so rather than thinking, is it something like Twitter comes out and immediately people say, well, it's just for kids or it's just a nonsense. And you know, I'm thinking, what if lawyers start to use it? I know half a dozen GCs are already tweeting. So I say to the law firms advising them, if my client was tweeting, which is to say they're broadcasting on a regular basis what they're up to, I don't want to be receiving.
Well, listen, Richard, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
For this fascinating, and I hope that the listeners will get your book.
Great stuff. Thank you.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.